What do you believe should be the top issue for lawmakers in Tallahassee? Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald have once again launched their influencer series. It looks at the issues that readers care about most. Now in its second year, readers have changed their priorities from 2018, and we'll talk to the series editor, Kristen Roberts. Also, we'll hear from the Coast Guard about a growing issue of illegal charter boats. And is climate change leading to more gentrification? What about political corruption? The Museum of Art and Design in Miami is hosting a series of talks about the issue, and we'll get a preview. Finally, have you been in the Miami-Dade County Fair? It's got its share of rides and food, but the fair is also teaching young people about life in agriculture. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. What is the most important issue for you living in South Florida? Lawmakers are in Tallahassee now determining laws that are going to impact you, your family, your community. If you could tell them about one issue most pressing for you, what would it be? Well, last year, the Miami Herald launched its influencer series. They heard from their readers on the biggest issues that lawmakers needed to tackle. This year, they spoke with more of these so-called influencers from across the state about the issues closest at the heart to them. Now, we're joined now by Kristen Roberts, the editor running the influencer series at the Miami Herald. Again, a project that aims to identify solutions to the policy problems that Floridians care about most. And she's joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Kristen Roberts, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure completely.
So, you know what? I gave a brief description, but how do you describe to someone what the influencer series is? What is it trying to accomplish?
The influencer series is our attempt to really go big on policy problems and policy solutions. We launched it because we know two very clear things about our readers. They want journalists to help elevate policy issues over politics, and they're desperately hungry for a civil dialogue about potential solutions to the problems that are really getting in the way of creating a better Florida for all Floridians. So rather than just assigning reporters to cover policy issues, which we do, we decided to launch a big project to connect our audience with influential voices throughout the state, all with the intent of finding some common ground and giving suggestions to Tallahassee.
So just to clarify, too, it's not just Miami Herald readers. I mean, this is a collaboration, right, with the Miami Herald, El Nuevo Herald, I believe the Bradenton Herald, other newspapers.
That's absolutely right. So three of the newsrooms in Florida. It's also a project that our parent company, McClatchy, is doing nationwide in other large communities, including Sacramento, North Carolina, and we're looking at doing it in Texas in 2020 as well.
You had this group of people that you found, these influencers, and I mean, you're talking about people from all walks of life, professors, bankers, director of a coffee shop, all kinds of industries, and you bring them together because you want to hear their thoughts of what's going on in their community, what's important to them. But how did the news organization go about finding these people? What makes an influencer?
Oh, that's a very good question. Let's start by talking about how we define it, right? We deliberately define influencer broadly. These are people who represent all parts of our many and varied communities. So some are large employers, some represent employees, some are academic leaders, and some are community organizers. We've got people who represent the faith community, people who have dedicated their careers to public service. But we started with our readers. We asked them to nominate people to be influencers, right? And we also went to officials. We went to the public and private sector, to leaders across the state, and said, you nominate also. We opened that nomination process in November. And then starting in January, we began to vet that list because we really did want it to represent Florida along racial lines, gender lines, political lines. And also, we wanted it to be a list of people that had some balance between traditional business sectors and also public advocates.
And you had the influencers from last year. This year, is it a new group of influencers?
All are new with the exception of 10. So 10 of the 50 are carryovers from 2018. And we did that because we didn't want the work that was done by this group in 2018 to just disappear. I think one of the most powerful parts of this project was the white paper that the 2018 influencers generated in November and sent up to the Capitol and to every elected official in the state. And we didn't want those issues just to die or those recommendations to be forgotten. And so 10 of those influencers are serving again in 2019 with the key goal of keeping that stuff alive and keeping an eye on what Tallahassee is doing with those recommendations.
And I want to ask you about the white paper here in a moment. But the other thing, too, is you ask readers their thoughts. What are the issues that are most important? What was the top of the list for readers last year?
Last year, it was split between two things. One, economic inequality. And two, gun safety. And I think that made a lot of sense for 2018. We as a state were coming out of the tragedy that was Parkland. And so gun safety and gun violence was very much top of mind for so many of our readers and certainly your listeners as well. Economic inequality was far and away the top of the list, which was interesting to me, certainly. It was the top of the list both among our Spanish-speaking audience and our English-speaking audience.
And that's changed. Going into this year, you ask readers what's important to them, and it's different.
Fascinating. Fascinating. In 2019, our readers are focused intently on environmental issues. Far and away, the top issue that our readers told us about was sea level rise, followed by transportation, but not infrastructure the way it was last year. It was actually traffic problems, stuff that really affects their day-to-day lives. Third was education. Fourth was both housing affordability, but also affordable housing, which really are two different things, right? And then there's cost of health care, and then water quality comes back to round out number six.
And again, this is across the board with all the different readers that you have. So you come into this year, and, you know, as you said, that changed. The issue of guns fell way back down the list. Do we have any idea why? Why the readers have changed their minds?
Well, we're going back to the readers now to ask that very question. I mean, we asked them to tell us what the issues were that were most important to them. And right now we're engaged in the process of talking with them and now with the influencers as we asked them to do the same thing that the readers did, which is rank the issues. But it is absolutely one of our questions from the newsroom. Gun safety and gun violence was so important to you last year. Why this year has it fallen all the way down to, you know, essentially spot number seven on a list of 10? It's fascinating to me. Frankly, it might be about, it might just be a reflection of the cross-section of human beings who responded to the survey this time, right? But it's why we're doing our due diligence on this list. We're going back to our readers and saying, tell us more about this.
We're talking with Kristen Roberts, editor in charge of the newsrooms in McClatchy's East Region, including the Miami Herald, and she's running the Miami Herald's Influencer Series. And if you want to learn more about that series, we do have a link on social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Kristen, let's get back to the white paper. So you create this white paper. This, again, what you want lawmakers to understand about what the readers are telling you is important. What kind of response did you get about that?
Well, the white paper was a partnership project between you guys over at WLRN and the Herald. And the aim here was to pull all of these influential people into a room and split them up into working groups assigned to each one of the policy areas. And we filled these working groups with people who would not naturally come together to talk about these issues. And they came up with consensus positions that were not they weren't weak positions, right? They were strong and interesting and unexpected. And so what came out of that working session was the white paper. And the white paper lists a series of recommendations that our elected officials, working sometimes in partnership with the private sector, should explore en route to a solution to a problem that has been identified by our audiences as important to them. So we produced it, we printed it, and we hand-delivered it to every elected official in Tallahassee and also made copies available to all elected officials throughout the state.
And was there any response? Did any lawmaker come back and say, this is fascinating and, you know, I'm looking into these?
We did receive prompt response from many of them. Sometimes it was thanks. They had never really received a product like this that reflected the sentiments of Floridians and the consensus position of leaders in the state. And, you know, with time, we're going to see whether they can rally to act on these issues.
And is there a way to track and see, you know, with all of the issues that the readers again said were the influencers and the readers again said were important to them, you know, how lawmakers performed in the last session, just, you know, before, as we finish up this session, you know, we want to get a sense of, are they listening? Are they really interested in, you know, tackling these issues?
That is an assignment for this newsroom, right? One of the things we did to keep track of that is to keep 10 of the influencers from last year on the panel this year. So they are doing the work of being in touch with the lawmakers and actually writing about the progress Tallahassee is making on the opinion pages of the Herald. But in addition to that, we've got a team that's dedicated to this influencer series, and they are going to be doing the work in the days ahead to track exactly what the response was and the product was coming out of our efforts last year.
Kristen Roberts, the editor running the influencer series at the Miami Herald. You can find a link on our social media at WLRN Sundial to learn more about it. Kristen Roberts, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, she joined us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Well, still to come, is there a problem with illegal charter boats off our coast? We're going to hear about a Miami Vice case from last year that's raised the profile of the problem. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the United States Coast Guard has ramped up its efforts to crack down on illegal charter boats. This past weekend, they busted three illegally chartered boats near the Ultra Music Festival. These busts can lead to major fines and other charges if the Coast Guard finds you in violation, like things for not having a certificate of inspection. Lieutenant Jorge Santiago is a Marine investigator with the United States Coast Guard Miami Sector, and he joins us now in studio. Lieutenant Santiago, thank you so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
First of all, let's define what an illegal charter is. What is it you guys are looking for exactly?
No problem. So basically, when we're talking about illegal charters, we have to define the different operations that people can actually undergo, right? So you can either operate commercially or recreationally. When you decide to operate commercially, that's when the certificate of inspection comes in play, and that the Coast Guard will regulate your vessel, and you could go through a rigorous inspection process. You can also operate as an uninspected passenger vessel, but you will be limited to 6 passengers, and you will still be required to have a captain's license, rolled in a drug and alcohol program, and whatnot. When it comes to illegal charters, that would be a recreational voyage. And in order to be a legal bareboat charter, you would need to meet all the requirements as found in the Passenger Vessel Safety Act of 1993.
So you said you can have up to 6 people in your boat. After that,
that's when you're operating commercially as an uninspected, right?
Okay.
For our bareboat charter, you can have up to 13 persons on board. It will be the charterer, the person that's doing the charter, and then 12 of his guests.
I see. I was just trying to figure out, like, what is it you're looking for when you are, I guess, you know, patrolling the area and you see a boat with a lot of people on it. What is it you're looking for? What tells you, wait a minute, we need to check this out?
So what we're looking for, in essence, is the kind of operation that people are doing. You see a vessel that's more than likely overloaded. Maybe you're going to have 15, 18, 20 passengers. That's we go on board and we identify and we start asking the regular questions that we would in order to identify the kind of operation and ensure the safety of the public and overall.
And, you know, so I'm wondering, for me, if I wanted to start, a charter service, how many licenses do I need to do this?
So when we're talking about chartering and bareboat charters, there is not a license requirement. Basically, what you will have to do is follow the 7 elements that are required in the Passenger Vessel Safety Act. And when you follow those 7 elements, those elements are basically going to guide the contract that you will provide to the passengers that are going to be on board. You provide that to the charterer. That person becomes the owner of the vessel for a predetermined amount of time. And the 7 elements, if I can run them through you real quick, element number 1 is the charterer, the person going into the charter that becomes the owner, needs to have a captain and crew selection. The master shall be paid by the charterer. The pilotage and fuel and food and everything has to be paid in by the charterer. All port and pilotage fees covered by the charterer. The insurance is obtained by the charterer. The charterer has the right to discharge for cause the captain and crew if they don't meet his standards or anything. And the vessel needs to be surveyed upon delivery and return. Those are the seven elements that need to be met.
So the other thing, just to make sure, is that if I own the boat, but I'm not the one, you know, if I allow somebody else to use it as, you know, for charter or whatever purposes, I have to determine that that's the person who's going to be, he's got the captain's license, he or she has the captain's license. They're going to be in charge of all those things, or because it's my boat, I'm responsible for all that.
So when, if you're the owner of the vessel,
yes,
and you're going to charter your vessel in a bareboat charter process or okay, agreement, you cannot be on board the vessel because you would be relinquishing ownership to the individual that's signing.
Okay.
That person needs to have a captain and crew selection. He can bring his own captain, or you as the owner can provide him a list of captains that you have previously vetted that you know are capable of driving your vessel, and that's the way the charterer selects the captain.
Why are illegal charters becoming a problem now? Is it really a big issue that you're seeing?
Illegal charters have always been a problem, especially in this area that it's summer 24/7. But we've had different cases, and we're having additional approaches in order to ensure compliance with this program.
And what's the risk or danger that you see, whether it's to passengers or anybody else in the water? What's the danger of having illegal charters around?
The biggest danger of having illegal charters or not following the requirements of the Passenger Vessel Safety Act comes to the actual safety of passengers. You have a vessel that could potentially be overloaded, and you put passengers and people around you at risk. That is the biggest issue that we have.
I'm talking with Lieutenant Jorge Santiago of the U.S. United States Coast Guard, Miami Sector. The Coast Guard has been cracking down on illegal charter boats with numerous fines and busts across South Florida over the past couple of months. But as he said, it is summertime here most of the year, so this is an issue year-round. The past weekend, they made three illegal charter busts connected to the Ultra Music Festival. There was a case last year that really raised the profile of these illegal charters. This is the death of Raul Mendez on a boat called Miami Vice in Biscayne Bay. Very interesting, very unique, very disturbing case. What was unique about that case?
What was unique about that case, just to do a quick recap, this is all public records, but this vessel was found operating as an illegal charter previously to that day. It was issued a notice violation from the Coast Guard. It was identified. We tried to correct any further violations that they could potentially have. We fast forward to the day of the incident, and the Coast Guard would not have been involved in that, identifying that it's an illegal charter, if it wasn't for the casualty. So on the onset of this incident, the individuals were operating as an illegal charter. So what was unique about this case, it's the investigation. So one thing doesn't marry with the other, because we do the investigation for illegal charters, and the other was a criminal charge based on U.S. Code 115, commonly known as seaman's manslaughter.
Now, there are fines if you're caught running an illegal charter. But then the other thing, too, is that once you board that boat, you could probably find a whole bunch of other things.
That is correct.
That they're doing. So fines can just start to pile up.
That is correct. That is correct. So basically, we try doing the fines that we issue to these individuals are based on the kind of operation that they're doing. If the vessel is being found as operating as a certificated vessel, then those are the fines, because you're operating in that capacity, and we will fine you in the capacity that you're operating.
If I'm operating an illegal charter, just that, mm-hmm, what kind of fines am I looking at?
So you're looking at potentially $63,000 in fines if we go max, because you have not having the licensed captain, not having the drug and alcohol consortium, not having a certificate of inspection, not having your stability letter, and if your vessel is over 5 net tons, you would need to have a certificate of documentation in order to operate commercially.
There have been illegal charter boat busts in Holliver, in the Keys, and near Miami Beach. Is the Coast Guard focusing on specific regions? Do you tend to see these things happening in certain areas?
What do you mean, certain areas?
Certain parts of South Florida more than others, I should say.
I would say yes and no. Not only in South Florida, we're also targeting this. This mission is being pushed throughout the Coast Guard. You will find incidents like this in St. Pete. You will find incidents like this in Chicago. You will find incidents like this in Puerto Rico. Different sectors are actually trying to get people in compliance. You hear it more here because, like we mentioned, it's summer 24/7. You got places like Chicago, New York, north parts. When the winter comes, you don't see a lot of charters. But Miami, basically, you have it a lot based on the profile that Miami brings.
Boating is so big in Florida in general. So it's, again, all over Florida. We got a question from one of our listeners in Monroe County. Will the United States Coast Guard also be cracking down on illegal fishing charters? This remains a big issue for fishermen, especially down in the Keys. What about fishing charters?
The fishing charters are vessels that are operating as an uninspected passenger vessel most of the time. So we have our own divisions and our own areas that are focused on fishing vessels. They inspect fishing vessels and they bring them to compliance and ensure they're operating within the scope of law.
And besides just folks who operate their own boats or they're operating a boat as an illegal charter, what about for just regular people if they're looking at finding a charter to be able to go out, whether it's just for sightseeing or fishing? What would you tell? What kind of advice do you give people as to what they should be looking for to be careful?
Definitely. I would tell the public, number one, know which operation you're doing. If you're operating if you're going into a commercial operation, like they're saying they're going to take you to point A to point B, and that's it, make sure the captain has the little red book. It's called a Coast Guard Maritime Credential. They need to be licensed for commercial operations.
Wait, I can say, do you have the little red book?
You can ask him, Captain, can I see your license? And ask the captain. You ask the captain, and they will provide you, and they will answer your questions. However, if you're in a bareboat charter, please make sure that you know that it's a bareboat charter. You, as the charterer, signed your contract. Review the contract, because you become the owner of the vessel for that amount of time. Make sure that you don't have over 12 guests plus you, so no more than 13 passengers. And that way, everything starts rolling, and everything starts panning out better. There is no requirement for captains to have a license for a bareboat charter. So that's something big. So if you ask the captain, can I see your license, and you don't see one in a bareboat charter, it's not to be alarmed. They're not required. They probably will have it. A lot of them do. It's part of the lowering insurance costs, and it's better if you have a professional mariner. But they're not required to. So always ask your captain and make sure that everything pans out. If you have any questions, call your nearest Coast Guard sector, and we will be more than happy to assist you.
And also, you know, I wanted to ask about, the drug and alcohol program. I wanted to know about, because, again, once you get on that boat, you're going to find maybe other issues. But what have you seen when it comes to, you know, the issue of drugs or alcohol on boats, these illegal charters? Is that also a big problem?
So when we conduct those boardings, it all starts as a recreational safety boarding. We want to make sure that everything is safe, that individuals have enough life jackets, that the vessel is good, is not taking in water and all that things. That's how everything starts. Then from that, it evolves to a charter investigation, if you don't call it something. That's when you start asking the question, I identify the operation that the vessel is actually undergoing. So when it comes to drug use and excessive alcohol use, then the Coast Guard, small boat station, are the ones that identify if there are drugs, and they will take the necessary actions against those kind of actions.
Again, just looking back, I mean, is this, you know, especially as we're coming now into the spring and things are starting to warm up a little bit, do you start to see more of this is a big problem here, the illegal charters?
This is a consistent problem.
It's consistent.
It's consistent. That is correct.
Lieutenant Jorge Santiago of the United States Coast Guard Sector Miami, he is, again, the Coast Guard cracking down on these illegal charter boats. As he said, ask those questions. Know who the captain is. You can ask the captain for the license. Or again, if you're going to be operating that boat, make sure that you understand these regulations. We're going to make sure that we post this up online as well, so you know those points, things that you need to be following. Lieutenant Santiago, thank you for your time.
No problem. My pleasure.
All right, still to come, we're going to look at a series of talks that go into the issue of sea level rise and gentrification here in South Florida. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the impacts of climate change has become a part of our daily lives here in South Florida. But how often do we think about the ways that it leads to corruption or even gentrification? The Museum of Art and Design in Miami has been hosting a series of talks the past 2 months called Superflex. We are all in the same boat, Miamians. It looks at how all these issues intersect. Their next panel conversation is tomorrow. Now, we spoke with two of the panelists invited to the museum to talk about these topics. Mariana Boldu, she's the landscape architect and director of resilience design at Curtis and Rogers Design Studio. She's also a board member of the City of Miami Sea Level Rise Committee. And we also talked to Timothy A. Barber, the executive director of the Black Archives in Overtown and former member of the City of Miami Historic and Environmental Preservation Board. They talked to us about the importance of community involvement.
It has always been a known fact that the Overtown area has always been land that has been looked at from whites in terms of wanting that land because it was prime real estate. We've seen this change in infrastructure first by the removal of the economy from that neighborhood in efforts to decrease property value. And then there was no infrastructure being given to it other than if you look, it was vacant land everywhere. So we find that this land back in the day was urban renewal, but it became urban removal. We find that we're faced with this issue of gentrification, which is a bad word in the minority neighborhoods.
Is the idea of climate change and sea level rise a topic of conversation in these neighborhoods?
That isn't the topic of the conversation, but they can feel the impact from the invasion of the high rises, the invasion of the movement to inland. Because if you look at home ownership in these areas that are predominantly black areas, it's non-existent. As prior to the early 20th century, there was home ownership. So when you don't own the land, a lot of times don't have much say in what happens to it. So it may not be a discussion of sea level rise, but there is a discussion that the tide is changing.
And are we holding developers in Overtown accountable to ensure that, you know, that it's they've got that inclusive housing, affordable housing, as this climate gentrification is happening?
There's always a discussion in terms of what do we do with the people that are already residing in this location. But without checks and balances, you have the CRA that tries to do this checks and balance and making sure that the people that live there will not be removed. But that's a difficult process when you set parameters. I always say that he who write laws rule the land. And if the rules of acquiring this affordable housing is not written in favor of people that are affected by displacement, then they would never win.
So what's your biggest fear going forward, looking in the future?
Well, I mean, for the community is that the shape of the community will begin to change. I mean, in terms of that's why you have the importance of the Black Archives, Historic Lyric Theater, and the other historical landmarks is to make sure that no one forgets what existed in that land. But we're faced with the fact that it is changing and there will be change. And you see the change happening each and every day that you are in that area.
Mariana, I come to you. I mean, as a landscape architect, you have worked on a waterfront project that sought to expose the rising sea levels and of course, the dangers posed on the coral reefs off the Miami coastline. But explain the project and the purpose behind it. What are you doing?
I would like to touch a little bit up on what Timothy says. You know, the city of Miami is really making an effort to address all these things, and they're working on refining policy because they're fully aware of these dynamics at play. You can be assured that it's on the table of the conversations, you know, as far as if all the stakeholders that need to be involved are sitting at the table, that's a different conversation, right? So ideally, we'll get there, but there are things being done. And I just want to extend an invitation for anyone that would like to attend the Sea Level Rise Committee meetings. They happen every first Monday of the month. Moving to what you ask about this project, back in 2017, the DDA, you know, the Downtown Development Authority, put out an RFP, request for proposal, to envision the waterfront of Miami. So the way they crafted this was to find a collection or a set of unifying elements to give the Baywalk cohesiveness and identity. So we participated on that, and we actually reached out to Superflex because we thought they were very progressive in their understanding of living with water and also environmental art. And we came up with some fascinating ideas for the Baywalk. So the project does reflect into the fact that coral reefs are not only at peril, but are a fundamental part of our defense along with the mangroves, and recreates that in a very poetic form through a collective art installation for the Baywalk.
And something real quickly too is this. I mean, the two of you are coming at this issue from two very different places.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
How do they connect?
I see the connections at many levels, you know, because at the end of the day, facing climate change and life, you know, it's about how we come together as a community. We need to all be together, you know, moving forward and think about equity, you know. And when I think about it, I kind of extended it even further, because, you know, our health as a community relies on our natural systems. And we also apply kind of the same principles. Gentrification actually applies to nature, because we don't take care of nature. We displace it. That's why the coral reefs are at peril, you know, globally and locally. That's why we almost extincted the mangroves locally.
Timothy, your take. How do these two come together?
I mean, from a perspective, a Black perspective in the community that which I come from, you know, the conversation is not sea level rise. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the science of extinction. What it is, it's the science of survival.
Absolutely.
And, you know, from a perspective of understanding, there's so many other issues that are at play in a community that's being displaced, that, you know, you look to the higher ups to protect or to represent you at these meetings. But, you know, sometimes that's not happening for people that are unaware of why they are being displaced. One thing affects the other, and there is a tie into it. But for people of color and that's in this community to get an understanding of this, it's a little difficult. You know, it's a little further fetched for them to, even myself, to connect to that when there are other issues at play in terms of why we are losing our land, why we are being displaced, why we are being rerouted.
Again, we're talking with Timothy A. Barber, president of the Black Archives in Overtown, and Mariana Boldu, director of resilience and design at Curtis and Rogers Design Studio. Again, we're discussing, of course, the nexus of climate change, gentrification, and corruption, and how all these things tie in together. Really, for both of you, and Mariana, I'm going to start with you, how landscape design, how we're thinking about our city, you know, how this reflects on the issue. And I know you talk about survival, but the issue of sea level rise, because it is going to impact all of us. How are we adapting to this future?
We have to green our city big time. So we have to get rid of paving. That means more trees, more pervious areas, more sponge. You know, we sit on a sponge, but on top of it, we put a cap of concrete throughout. So that's what we need to kind of revert back. You know, we need to start getting rid of the concrete and putting the green back, because the green has so many, many benefits, from absorption to, you know, sinking carbon, to improving water quality, air quality, health, all of that.
Timothy, I think about the future is that there's going to have to be a constant redesign of the infrastructure. That's going to reshape neighborhoods. It's going to force you to.
Yeah, I kind of just walk backwards just a moment and agree totally what the doctor has said in terms of what we have to rethink. The issue is that whether or not we're learning from our mistakes of the past, and are we repeating these things? And because if you look at it, for example, a lot of us ride the expressway, and you have to ask yourself every time, how many times we're going to redesign this roadway? You know, how many times, you know, we'll go to six lanes, we'll come back to five, and you're like, who is the person sitting around trying to design it? Can we get one good design? So there's never a really true answer to it. But if we begin to play back to what our ancestors has done and planting indigenous plants that were here, because there was a lot of removal going on. And really back then, they didn't understand the role of certain plants when you talk about the mangroves and the coral reefs. So they begin to remove these things in the name of development. And we're now seeing the effects of that. And that's what, 30, 40, 50 years later, we're now understanding these effects. And people are now trying to fix those things. So I think that depending on scientists and the professionals, people that are really studying this climate issue and studying how to make the space green, we depend on the people, the experts, to basically get it right, you know, and then listen to those people that have the knowledge.
Do you have confidence in those experts?
Certain people,
you know, she reminded me of somebody that I have confidence in, Mr. Gerald Martian, who I sat on the board with. It has been interesting sitting on the City of Miami Historical Environmental Protection Board, because you have many people that think we're crazy for trying to save a tree. We have developers come in and, why do I have to save this tree? Can I just mitigate, you know? And it's like, no, we don't want you to mitigate, because that really doesn't help us, because it's going to take a lifetime for that tree to grow to its full health.
Timothy, what do you hope people are going to take, or do you want them to take from this conversation?
I just want people to become sensitive to these issues and how they all connect in a sense when you talk about climate change, gentrification, as well as corruption, because one does feed the other. And that's why we're here. We're here because of the corruption that affect climate change, that push people out and begin to gentrify people. So I hope that people will begin to be wise about this and then take notice and show up to this first Monday meeting of the month that will help them understand a little bit better and then carry that knowledge back to people that don't understand.
And Mariana, you as well. What do you hope people will get from this?
It's to think about their own personal choices and empower them to take action at many different levels. You know, I think when we talk about corruption, it's about using something to your own benefit. We are all corrupted somehow and at some level, you know, so we all share responsibilities. You either show up for these things or you don't show up, and both of them had an implication. So I would encourage everybody, as Timothy said, to show up and to hold, you know, our politicians accountable for their decisions.
So we just heard from Timothy A. Barber, Executive Director of the Black Archives in Overtown, and Mariana Boldu, Director of Resilience and Design at Curtis and Rogers Design Studio. We spoke to them a couple of weeks ago. They were part of a panel discussion at the Museum of Art and Design in Miami about the connections between climate change, gentrification, and corruption. The next panel conversation at the museum is tomorrow. Well, still to come, have you been to the Miami-Dade County Fair? It's a lot more than just the rides and the funnel cakes. We're going to learn about the pipeline for young people into the ag industry. It's all coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Agriculture is a key part of Florida's economy. It's estimated $104 billion each year is generated from ag, and that puts 2 million people to work. But nationwide, the agriculture industry is aging out. The average age of a farmer is now 58 years old. What's the next generation of farmers going to look like? Well, the Miami-Dade County Fair is now in its 68th year with a focus on youth education and teaching students about the ag industry. Eddie Cora is the president of the Youth Fair, joins us to talk about what the fair teaches students about the region's agriculture industry and, of course, all the rides and the funnel cakes and everything else. Eddie, great to have you.
Thanks for having me today.
We think about fairs, you think about the rides, you think about all the kinds of food that you can get, but there is something unique about this fair, is that it puts this focus on educating kids, students, on the agriculture industry, which is so big in Florida. But how do you do that at this fair? How do you mix the fun with the education?
Well, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it, because all fairs in the state of Florida are actually chartered as agricultural fairs. We're special or different in a way of we're an agricultural fair in an urban setting. So what we look at is in two ways. Number one, we want to teach the students or the kids of this community that, you know, milk doesn't come from Publix. You know, a salad does not come from Panera.
I hope they know that.
You know, okay. You'll be surprised. You know, so what we try to do with our ag program, like you said, not only the state, but in Miami-Dade County, agriculture is the number two driver of the economy. These are not jobs you see on the e-network. These are second, third generation farmers. What we provide the students from the school systems, the opportunity to get into an agribusiness project and teach them agriculture from a business side. Somebody's got to take over the family farm. Somebody's got to take over the family business.
What's interesting, like, for example, what you teach students about animals, different farm animals, not just what they are and understand, but also how to take care of them, as you said, from a business perspective, which is keeping records, vet bills, all these things that you have to think about. Why take it that far?
Well, the understanding needs to come from a very early age, because it's like any business owner. It doesn't matter whether you own a nail salon, a 7-Eleven, or a farm. you still have to understand the business side of it. So it's an opportunity for the fair to get involved and help these kids learn the business side without losing their own money. It's that, you know, that training wheels of it. You know, in our agriculture, we have two parts. We have the horticulture and the agriculture. And we partner with Miami-Dade Public Schools and their agricultural programs for the large animals. We're talking the steers, the hogs, the lambs. That's part of the component. But specifically what we do with them is we're teaching them the animal production business. At the end of the day, you know, there is a food chain that keeps going, and there's somebody that's providing the animals and the meat for these vendors. These kids are learning how to not only buy the animal from the sense of which animal to buy, the selection process. They're learning, you know, the cost of the animal, the cost of the feed. You know, they learn very quickly you can overfeed an animal and to be unhealthy.
And you also bring in experts. You bring in people from the ag industry to talk with the students and teach them about what that industry really is and what it does.
That exactly. And we kind of partner with what they're learning or on top of what they're learning at the school system. They have some great teachers at the school system, but you're talking about a classroom setting of an hour a day. So what we try to do is bring them out. And we do this for poultry. We do this for large animals, for steers. We do it for everything. We try to partner with the state of Florida. We start to partner with experts in the industry to come down and teach the students how to properly buy their animal, care for their animal, the importance of a vet. You know, the vets are very important, but what you can do along the way of raising your animal to avoid unnecessary vet costs and raise a healthy animal. And that's the goal. So they're learning how to raise a healthy animal for production or for, you know, just personal gain, and show them at the end of the project through keeping logs. They monitor how much they spend on feed, how much they spend on medical care, how much the cost was.
So you're not going, it's not a petting zoo. You're not going to touch animals. This is a full set program again with the schools teaching kids really about the industry. How many young people have you heard tell you, like, you know what, now all of a sudden I'm kind of interested in this industry?
That's the most gratifying part, because number one, when you come out to the fair, and by the way, what we're talking about is the heartbeat of the fair. We all know the food and the rides. That's the fun. The heartbeat is what we do with the kids. The reason we put on the fair is so that we can raise money to give back to these kids for these programs. The fair is just a giant fundraiser put on by a private charitable organization. So what we're allowed to do, you start talking to these kids during it, and you see they start understanding, maybe this is my future. I can take over my parents' business, or maybe I can start my own farm. We have success stories where there are individuals right now working for the state of Florida in the inspection process for the Department of Agriculture that came through our program, learned about animals, and got that drive, that passion through our fair, and they come back and help those kids. They're mentors now for those kids. It's a good thing to see.
The fair also has a student exhibit portion. This is a program where the fair, again, partnering with Miami-Dade Public Schools to implement into the curriculum. This is students who showcase some of the stuff that they've worked on, everything from things in sewing and cooking to robotics and aerospace. But what kind of submissions have you gotten? What have you seen this year?
That is the fun part. You go through Arnold Hall and you're seeing everything from creative writing, both in English and Spanish. There's an ESOL program also. Fine arts. Some of the artists in this community, it's incredible. I can't do stick figures, but you see the depth of the artistry. What it shows you when you go through Arnold Hall is the creativity and the talent that we have coming up in this county. You can walk through Arnold Hall and feel very good as you get older in this county that you're going to be well taken care of. When you look at the architectural programs, the robotic programs, these are kids that are, they could be in middle school, and they're building drones, they're building robots, they're programming them. It is incredible. Again, I feel great knowing I'm in good hands when I walk through there.
I'm talking with Eddie Cora, president of the Miami-Dade County Fair, which is wrapping up this weekend. The month-long fair is focused on raising funds for youth educational programs and includes training programs for students interested in pursuing careers in agriculture. Now, The fair has been through some interesting stuff over the last couple of years. I mean, there was questions about its location and whether or not it was going to stay in that place where
you heard about that.
Yeah, we all remember that one. Then it was last year. And this one, I wanted to get your take on this real quickly. You had activists show up with state officials, elected officials. They were at a rally and they wanted to end the gun show that was there on the fairgrounds. Real quickly, just help us understand the connection with the gun show.
Well, outside of the fair, the Miami-Dade County Fair Exposition, Inc., who we lease the land, we lease the property for other shows, for other cultural events. They could be an orchid show, an antique show, a home show, Cuban nostalgia, the Liga Contra Cancer telethon. So we have about 70 other events. And one of the events, one of the promoters that comes to rent the space is for the gun show. And yes, there were some elected officials, not coincidentally, on an election year. I'd be curious if you see him again, but we'll see.
Have you seen anybody this year?
No. However, I've had some very, very productive conversations with some of the people that were out there. There was a misunderstanding on their side. They thought that we were, number one, they thought we were promoting the gun show. No, we're not. We are a venue that leases the buildings for the gun show. We have no say in content or in pricing or in messaging. As long as that Any promoter can go through the permit process at Miami-Dade County, gets a permit to hold an event on the fairgrounds, and they can meet the insurance requirements, then we are legally bound to rent it. The issue of the gun show is very different because gun shows around the country fall under both state and federal laws, and there are there's federal precedent that it's not a Second Amendment issue, it's a First Amendment issue, it's a free speech issue. So we follow the law. When the law changes, then we'll follow it again. But as it is, we're very fortunate that we have a very good gun show promoter.
68th year now in Miami-Dade County. Why has it had such staying power?
I think because the focus has always been on the youth. They've been on the students, it's been on their creativity, on showcasing that creativity, on enhancing it, promoting it, and celebrating it. The one thing that we'll never run out of is young people and great ideas. So our whole focus every year is how do we focus on the child, focus on the student, and at the same time provide the best value that we can for the family. We understand this is a blue-collar town. So we want to make sure that every family that comes out here can come out. For instance, today is $3 day. Everybody comes in for $3.
Well, you tell me this and I'm at work today.
Well, you know, we'll be open till late, so you can come on out. But imagine a family of four coming out for $12. And there'll be $3 food items at the and we're not talking bite-sized morsels. We're not doing hors d'oeuvres for $3. We're doing a true representation of that food stand. Games will be at $3. We want a family of four to come out and feel it's the best value they purchased all year. That's how you get to 68 years.
All right, you talked about food, and I don't want to leave you without having talked about this. Is that's another thing that fairs are well known for. It's the variety of choices. You know, the Miami Herald's food editor, our Carlos Frias, was out there, did a great little video, you saw it, about the variety of foods. I was fascinated by a very different take on the funnel cake, but what's unique about the Miami Fair when it comes to food? Is there something different this year? Are you always trying to change it?
Always. I mean, we're always trying to keep the nostalgia of the fair, but you always got to add something new. So this year what we did, and we have some great vendors, great food concessionaires. They're trying to do something different because at the end of the day, they got to attract you to their stand. So we have a dilly dog this year. For those of you who like dill pickles, it is a dill pickle hollowed out with a hot dog dipped in corn dog batter and deep fried. You got to watch people when they eat this. Their face goes from, what is this, to, oh my gosh, can I have another one? We have Fluffy's Donuts, where you can have a donut sundae. I mean, a big donut
with ice cream on top of it.
Yes. You know, I'm not sure what's wrong with that. But the one that I'm the most surprised about, and people who know my taste, I'm not a vegetarian at all, but we have an Impossible Burger. The entire burger, bacon, cheese, bun, vegan, top to bottom. I tell you, I've probably eaten dinner five times there.
And this is the, you know, the Impossible Burger is the one that's, it's no meat, but it is basically, it tastes, looks, feels like a beef burger.
I actually cut one in half and cut a hamburger in half and had both.
And you couldn't tell the difference.
And well, I could tell them when I looked at it, but when I tasted it, I ordered the Impossible Burger again.
The other thing real quickly too, with so much focus on ag, how much of with the food options are also, you know, from local farms, and it's that kind of a feel of a farm to table type of thing. Do you have that?
We are starting to get into that more. I'm working with my concessionaires for next year to see how we can partner. There's a number of programs now that have blossomed over the last couple of years that I want to reach out to and see how we can get them in touch with our concessionaires. The problem is volume for them. They just sell in such volume. We're hoping they can keep up, but we want to make that an option. We want to show off the Redlands. We want to show off Dade County agriculture.
Eddie Corr, president of the Miami-Dade County Fair, talking to us about the fair because it is coming to an end this weekend. So if you haven't been, you still got a few days left. Eddie, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. As we finish up the program here, by the way, listen to a little bit of the band Soul Packs that you're hearing. They are, by the way, part of Live from the 305. They're going to be performing this weekend as well, so at the fair. That's the program for this Wednesday, April 3rd. Find us again online at WLRN.org or find us on social at WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's vegan,